Yeah, so I'll try not to break any MOU rules, but I will say that, and this will be a theme of the talk, is of course Advanced LIGO has just begun, and so I'll say vaguely that it's an exciting time, regardless of what is or is not happening. Yeah, right. So thanks to Luis for inviting me. Thank you all for coming. I really appreciate being here. I don't mind saying I'm very impressed with the Institute. What a wonderful place to work. Wow. So it's really a pleasure to be here. All right. So I wanted to, I do think of myself as an experimentalist or maybe an observer or maybe a data monkey. But I am going to try and keep this talk focused I'm going to try and skirt over the details, and I'm going to try and talk about things that'll hopefully be of interest to this room, which may put me a little bit outside my comfort level, but that's okay. I think that's good for me too. But if you notice me flinching, then please be patient. So look, Advanced LIGO is starting. Okay, so here's an overview of the talk. Here's everything we're going to talk about today. Advanced LIGO recently began taking data. This is an exciting time. I think the nominal start of Advanced LIGO was September 18th, give or take. So we're something like a month into what we call the Advanced LIGO era, or Advanced Detector era. I'm going to emphasize, of course, there's many different, gravitational wave scenarios. People talk about stochastic signals and pulsar signals. I'm going to focus on gravitational wave transients. That's what I happen to work on, and I'm going to focus this talk on that. So this is maybe compact object mergers, maybe supernova, maybe other things we could imagine. And I'll try to focus on some science targets. So we'll talk about testing general relativity. We'll talk about constraining the neutron star equation of state. There's been a lot of really good work about how we might be able to do that. We'll talk about a topic I'm really interested in, which is describing the origins of heavy elements. So the R process elements in the universe, where do they come from? And of course, this is the kilonova model. So I'll try to provide some details about how we're hoping to find these things. And then, of course, there's some more general astrophysics that we can do as well. All right, so I wanted to start by setting the stage with this idea of gravitational wave transients. So I will give a very brief introduction to LIGO, but I do want to highlight that for this talk, we're going to talk about transients, and these are transients in the... Yeah, I'm with Luis. Pointer's no good. So we will talk about transients in the gravitational wave band. So the first thing that we tend to think of are compact object mergers. So something like a binary neutron star merger. At Advanced LIGO design sensitivity, we could see those out to something like 200 megaparsecs. And we can also talk about mergers of binary black holes. At something like design sensitivity, we could see those to something like a gigaparsec. Though there, it's actually very dependent on the mass. So we do have a frequency dependence and of course, larger, the amplitude of the signal does scale overall with the mass of the black hole. So more massive black holes we could actually see further. So with black holes in the LIGO band, you can even start to talk about, I don't know if that they're quite cosmological distances, but you can start to talk about distance scales that are beyond sort of the local universe. And then in the very local universe, we are sensitive to core collapse supernova. So at LIGO design sensitivity, a supernova would have to be basically within the galaxy, maybe in the LMC, maybe in a more extreme model as far away as Andromeda, but I doubt it. So there is thought to be a supernova in the galaxy, maybe once every 30 years or once per century, and we hope we'll be lucky enough to see one of those as well. Yeah, that's a great question. So the mass range we're sensitive to is, I'm trying to think if we should pull up a noise curve, but the mass range we're sensitive to are from, the lowest mass, right? So down to really neutron star masses. So say a solar mass we talk about say 10 solar mass black holes as the small ones, going up to a few hundred solar masses. So up to about 300 or 400 solar masses is what we're talking about. And then what happens is that larger masses, the merger frequency is too low frequency for our frequency band. Good. All right, so I'm guessing that most people in the room have heard of LIGO, but if not, I'll simply say that that LIGO exists. So LIGO are these, so the LIGO detectors are these 4 kilometer long detectors. LIGO is the American effort to use lasers to detect detect gravitational waves. The LIGO detectors, there's one in near Hanford, Washington. There's one near a town called Livingston, Louisiana. This is Louisiana. You can tell it's Louisiana because it's green. The Washington detector is in a desert, so those pictures are always brown. They're sensitive to very small values of gravitational wave strain, so perturbations to the metric of space-time of the order 1 part in 10 to the 22. You mentioned the sort of frequency band, which I should have put here but didn't. So our sensitive frequency band is somewhere between something like 50 hertz up to, say, a few kilohertz. Okay, so something like 50 hertz to, say, 2,000 hertz, more or less. And very important, there are some international partners in this endeavor. There's the GEO detector in Germany, the GEO 600. There's the Virgo detector in Italy. And also in the works now is the Kagra detector in Japan. There's also plans for how convenient, here's a map of the world. So you've got your two American detectors, we call them LIGO. There's the European detector. It's really, I think it's mostly an Italian-German partnership, Italian-French partnership with some international partners. That's Virgo. There's the GEO 600 detector. There are plans for a third LIGO detector located in India. We haven't quite gotten approval from the Indian government, so keep your fingers crossed. And then the Japanese detector Kagra is very much in progress, and they're I would say making progress very fast. They're a team to watch.
What's the difference in comparable to advanced LIGO and previous LIGO? Because I don't remember.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the plan is that advanced LIGO, advanced Virgo, and the design curve for Kagra are all similar scale. They're all within like factors of two of each other. So there are differences, you know, some do better at lower frequencies, some do better at higher frequencies. But the plans for Kagra is to have a detector that's sensitive, sensitivity similar to LIGO. So, you know, so they're still in kind of, I would say, installation or even a construction phase to some extent. So they're still, but they're hoping to have initial data as early as January. But that will not be at advanced LIGO sensitive. They're very ambitious. They have a very aggressive. Yeah, these people mean business. They're working very hard, I would say. And so their goal, you know, there's reasons to think that. So that won't be at design sensitivity. That'll be at some, you know, whatever, you know, the data they take in January. So they're still, I think, even by their aggressive schedule, I think they're still a few years away from sort of design sensitivity. But we're still a few years away from design sensitivity, so that's okay. But they are planning to very much be part of this network. And there's, in general, I would say that it's a good working relationship between all of these efforts, which is impressive given the number of people, so people get along. So there are data sharing, so the LIGO and Virgo collaborations are almost seamless at this point, and there is an MOU with Kagra, and we expect that by the time they're taking data, that this will be effectively one network. We expect to publish joint papers and all those kinds of things. Yeah, it's exciting. So here's a question about timeline. This is quoted from a paper that we've put on the archive that kind of lays out our plans. So these are not commitments, these are not promises, but these are kind of best guesses for how LIGO will perform. If you're able to read off these numbers, so you might not be used to staring at these curves. This is frequency on the x-axis, so the frequency of gravitational waves. So this is something like 100 hertz, which is where our most sensitive band is, up to about 1,000 hertz. And then this measure on the y-axis is the strain sensitivity. So we're sort of limited by some noise floor. And as you go further down this curve, you're getting more sensitive. And so the idea is that in something like early 2015, which by the way is now, we expected to have a binary neutron star. So we tend to measure our sensitivity in terms of how far away we could see a binary neutron star merger with some reasonable signal to noise ratio. Okay, so I'll probably slip into that jargon a lot. I'll say BNS range or neutron star merger range. And what I mean is the average distance to which we could see a binary neutron star merger. Is that simple enough? Okay. If I use when I use terrible jargon, please stop me. Please ask questions. I'm holding a hockey stick, so you shouldn't take me too seriously. maybe you should take me very seriously. Right. Yeah, so, okay. So in 2015, we were hoping for a noise curve something like this, which would allow us to see binary neutron star mergers out to something like 50 or 60 megaparsecs. The plan, and it's a vague and rough plan, but the plan is that sometime over the next year or two, we'll make some kind of minor commissioning improvements, which would give us another, say, 50% in range, and then some more down for what we call the third. So the idea is that this would be, we say, 01, 02, 03, observing one run, observing run two, observing run three. And so observing run three is planned for sometime in like 2017, 2018. And at that point, we're talking about more like 120, 150 megaparsecs, which is not quite design sensitivity, but it's close. And then Virgo has a similar schedule mapped out, though if you compare dates, you'll see that they're running about a year behind us. Okay, so Advanced LIGO has started with this initial sensitivity of somewhere between 40 and 80 megaparsecs now, and the plan is that Virgo will turn on with a similar sensitivity in a year. Does that make sense?
Okay. How is Virgo making that jump to the late high frequencies? It seems like
this jump here?
Yeah.
From here to here?
From the blue to the red.
Oh, I see, from here to here.
Yeah, because it seems like
those. Yeah, that's a good question. So I don't know for sure. I don't know details about the Virgo design, just because I don't have, but I do know that in that region, in that high frequency region, we tend to be dominated by shot noise. So quantum mechanical noise from the photons. And so the typical way that you do better at high frequencies is turning up the laser power. And turning up the laser power, there's lots of other technical problems that come up when you do that. So the idea is that you have to fix your other technical problems that allow you to turn up the laser power. And then when you get these kinds of gains at high frequencies, it's typically when you're able to do that. Okay, so this is some kind of snapshot of how Advanced LIGO is doing today. As it happens, this is a plot I grabbed from October 12th, so that's maybe a week ago. So the first observing run began September 18th. So this is a plot of our binary neutron star range, that BNS range. The hope was to get somewhere between like 50 and 80 megaparsecs, and we've got both detectors right around 70. So we're really, really happy and really proud of that. So what we're seeing today is we have an instrument which is sensitive to binary neutron star mergers out to about 70 megaparsecs. I wrote 4x initial LIGO on the slide, but it's actually just a little bit more than 4x initial LIGO. And so if you want to turn that into, Luis asked me this morning, how does today's sensitivity compare with initial LIGO sensitivity, right? And so of course we're sensitive to, we tend to think of it in terms of the volume of space that we're sensitive to, right? That scales with R cubed. So this 70 megaparsecs is a little bit more than 4x initial LIGO sensitivity. So you cube that and you get about 100. So it turns out that Advanced LIGO today is seeing something like 100 times the volume of what initial LIGO was seeing back in 2010. Okay.
I think this is typical of the duty cycle with the two detectors coming up. Why would it both turn off?
Well, yeah, so there are different things that cause them to turn off at the same time. So there's two questions there. Is this typical? It's typical-ish. I mean, I picked a good day, right? So put it this way. I had to go back a few days to find a duty cycle this high. So there are many things that can interrupt. So one common thing, where this is two, both of them getting interrupted at similar times, though it looks like it's about some time apart. So one thing that can happen a large earthquake anywhere in the world will take us out of lock. So anything above a magnitude 6, I think, on the Richter scale pretty much breaks our lock.
Anywhere
in the world. Yeah, the big ones, above 6 or 7, anywhere in the world takes us out of lock. And in Livingston in particular, the ground is swampy and slushy, so it kind of, the ring down time is long. And so, a big earthquake can take us out of lock for, half a day. There are regular maintenance breaks. Tuesdays, for example, we have a regularly scheduled maintenance break. And then there are other times when it's just, you know, you don't even, you know, you may or may not even know why. So there are, you know, the seismic motion in the ground does come up and down, right? And so there are times when, you know, the seismic, you know, we're getting into winter. Winter is harder than summer. Well, there's winds off the coast. And so ocean waves pummel the coast, and that tends to ring up the seismic. So the seismic levels are higher in, this is true, in winter than in summer. And it just makes everything less stable, right? And
so what is your upcycle? Let's say you have a science run of 3 months.
Yeah.
What percentage of that would take
So when we're really doing well, and we've been doing actually better than I thought we'd be doing at this stage, we do about 80% per detector. But then, of course, we're really interested in double coincident time. So you kind of have to multiply those. So you end up with about half. So about half the time we have 2 interferometers up, and half the time we have 1 or 0 interferometers up.
Yeah, I was thinking at 6 p.m. you all stop and start writing the paper.
Yeah. All right, so we'll try to talk. Okay, so I did want to give, so this is part of my general introduction. I did want to talk about this idea of searching for transient. So organizationally, we have 2 transient groups. We have what we call the CBC group, which are comp. So this group has a focus very specifically on compact binary mergers. So they're looking for mergers of black holes. They're looking for mergers of binary neutron stars. This group uses templates. So say, you know, waveform predictions for what a binary system will put out. These templates come from, to some extent, they come from numerical relativity, but really they're based on, it's a mix of numerical relativity and then sort of approximations, these sort of waveform families that are based on numerical relativity. If you know the jargon, it's things like FINOM-P and EOBNR, these sort of waveform families that predict, these signals. Maybe some people in here have worked on those things. Okay, so then there's this other group that's the Birch group. At the moment, I'm co-chair of the Birch group, and so we also search for transients, but we try to do it in a waveform agnostic way. So we use excess power methods to search for transients. So and transient, of course, means different things to different people. When I say transient, I typically mean something pretty quick, something like somewhere between say a millisecond and say a few seconds. Of course, these in-spiral signals can last in our band for as long as tens of minutes. But you know, when I say transient, I typically mean something.
So when you moderate, there's no waveform for those, but what you call a
burst? Right, so what we do for the burst is we're using excess power methods. So there's no waveform.
Okay.
So we do something like this. We make a spectrogram, right? So, you know, I think spectrograms, that's an okay word, right? That's not jargon, right? So we make a spectrogram, right? So you chunk your time up into little bins, you FFT each bin, and you say, oh, there was some extra power at this particular point in the time frequency plan. And then we try to get fancy because, of course, we have things like that all the time that arise from noise, right? You've got these mirrors and the lasers bounce around between the mirrors. The mirrors are always moving around a little bit. Maybe the laser clips the end of the mirror. Maybe some photons scatter off a piece of dust that happens to pass in front of the photodiode, on and on and on. So there's all kinds of things that can cause these, we call them glitches based on the noise. But our handle for dealing with that is we have 2 detectors and we use them. And so we try to very carefully check the consistency between the 2 detectors. So we look for coincidence, but even more than that, we actually do some somewhat intensive computation. We loop over every position in the sky as a sort of hypothesis and say, well, you know, these 2 glitches, these 2 signals we found in 2 detectors, is that consistent with an astrophysical signal coming from that point in the sky? And so we try very hard to look for things that are astrophysically consistent, but without relying on knowledge of waveforms. So we try to be as agnostic as possible about waveforms. And just for fun, I tried to think about, you know, it's kind of a needle in a haystack problem. We've got a lot of data. We're looking for very short signals. And just for fun, I was trying to think about how big our haystack is. And I claim that our haystack is something like 1 part in 10 to the 11, which is kind of impressive. I impressed myself. I said, wow, I didn't realize I could do that. All right, so. Yeah.
Currently you're about 100 times better, and so I guess that I remember hearing projections that it would go maybe a factor of 2 or more beyond that, and so get a factor of 1,000 over initial.
That is the goal. Yes.
And is that and how and how is that goal? Is that still looking as realistic as it once did? What's the major obstacle to that now? Does it seem or
yes? That's a great question. So the answer is yes. We still believe that we will be able to do that. Since you asked, I'm happy to confess that there is a technical problem that we don't understand, which is typical in this game, right? So, you know, with the initial detectors, there was a design sensitivity, and it took many years between when the detectors were built and when we reached design sensitivity. And we did reach design sensitivity, but it took longer than anyone thought it would. It took, I don't know, I mean, call it 5 or even 10 years of noise hunting, right? There's these, you know, you find some, you know, there's some noise in your detector, you don't know where it comes from, you spend time, you try to figure out where it's coming from, and then you fix it. We do have some mystery noise that is right in our bucket, so it's really limiting our sensitivity, right at 100 hertz, where we hope to be most, where we are most sensitive. And so there are people, you know, today working to track that down and understand what it is. They are optimistic that they will make progress and will be able to improve it, and I have confidence in them. So we do still believe that this schedule is realistic, but you know, there's uncertainties here, right? Delays are certainly possible. But the answer, you know, but one answer is we don't see any fundamental reason why we can't reach this, right? We haven't encountered any problems that are unsolvable. Okay, good. So I did want to highlight this idea of low latency analysis. This is something that I personally put a lot of time into, but I'll limit a few years worth of work to one slide here and just say that these searches for transients, we do them in what we call low latency, which means a few minutes. We have memorandums of understanding with a number of astronomy groups. And so what we do is we run our analysis quickly in a few minutes. We buzz our cell phones, we go check things out. If everything looks okay, then we send an alert to these astronomers, or in some cases robotic telescopes, which can then point and hope to find electromagnetic counterparts to any mergers. Okay, so there is very much an idea that LIGO can find exciting transients and then share that information with the astronomy community, and then the astronomy community can learn more about those exciting transients. Okay, and then as a final slide to my introduction, I wanted to talk about access to LIGO data. So I just mentioned that our low latency triggers, that we do share those with astronomer partners. That's within the confines of some memorandum of understanding. So there's a number of astronomers who have sort of committed to being inside to agree to certain data rights, and we share our triggers with them. I do want to highlight this guy, the LIGO Open Science Center. So we have made a commitment to making our full, what we call HFT, our full strain data available. We've already released initial LIGO data, so all of what we call S5 and S6. So all of the data where initial LIGO was at design sensitivity, it's something like 2007 to 2010, is now on the web. You can download it at lost.ligo.org. I'm one of the co-developers of this website. We've tried very hard to make it easy to use. There's tutorials, there's examples. In principle, everything you need to do to replicate our analyses are there, or more interestingly, to do your own analyses. And then crucially, any published discoveries, if and when those come, will have HFT data released, right? So it will be possible in the future, assuming that we get lucky and start to see some things, then you know, say 10 minutes or 20 minutes of data around that event will be released. And then it should be possible to you know, run your own tests of GR, extract source physics, whatever science you'd want to do with it. Okay, good. All right, so I wanted to talk about a few big science goals, and I wanted to start with this guy, the origin of our process elements. So as many people in this room may know, or may not, I don't know, the heavy elements in the universe, their origin is somewhat uncertain, right? So there's this very nice story that we're told in elementary school that matter comes from supernova, and to some extent that's true. It seems to be true for sort of the lighter elements, things that make up our bodies, oxygen and carbon and all these great things. But above an atomic number of something like 90, it's not clear that these elements can be produced in supernovas in the abundance we see. And so in particular, these elements are thought to be produced in what's called an R process of nuclear synthesis, where neutrons are rapidly captured. And so a process that seems to be a good candidate for doing this are these binary mergers. So, you know, this is a simulation from Roswag. What happens is when two neutron stars merge, there are these tidal forces and that rip matter out of the neutron stars. And this is actually ejected. So this has actually got enough kinetic energy. The velocity is higher than the escape velocity. So this matter actually leaves the system. And it's neutron-rich matter from inside these neutron stars. This R process can happen. And that's potentially where the heavy elements in the universe come from. Yeah, so that's a good question. And the models right now, so this is a modeling question, right? And it's an important modeling question. So the models right now are of order 1% of a solar mass. So maybe 0.1% or 1%, maybe up to a few percent of a solar mass.
And the product of the mergers usually black hole, or do they know?
Well, so that depends, right? So that depends on, say, the nuclear equation of state, right? So in general, and the masses, right? So if you have
matter mass in the universe, it lasts for a while, or from collapse, depending on the parameters of the galaxy.
Yeah. So you know, so if you have right, so if you have bigger neutron stars, say two solar masses, and they merge, and you know, then you might expect they collapse quickly to a black hole. If they happen to be on the smaller end of neutron stars, and if the equation of state is stiffer, then maybe, you know, maybe the pressure can support that and it remains a bigger neutron star. But I think that's a very interesting question. Right, so this R process is thought to happen. So these neutrons are captured, they form these heavy isotopes. The isotopes then go through this beta decay, which forms stable but heavy elements. And that releases energy, and this energy heats up the remnant and potentially forms a transient, and now I'm talking about an electromagnetic transient, that would have a time scale of something like a week or a couple of weeks. So this is something we could potentially see through a telescope, right? So we can imagine this scenario where there's a binary neutron star merger, not so far from Earth, maybe 100 megaparsecs, 200 megaparsecs away. LIGO would see it, we'd learn about it in the course of, say, 20 minutes. We'd share that information with our astronomer colleagues. They then, over the next couple of weeks, would take observations and search for this transient. There is, at least, there's a few candidates, but there is at least one well-known observation that seems to support this model. So these are images with the Hubble telescope. So there was a gamma ray burst that went off here, and this observation was taken, I think I've got this right, 9 days after the gamma ray burst or something like that. And then a few weeks later, they took a second series of observations, and they find, you know, they do image subtraction, and when they do the image subtraction, they find a transient right there, okay? And it's a little hard to see in this image, but it's further than the LIGO horizon. I think it's a few times the LIGO BNS horizon, a gigaparsec-ish, I think. I'm trusting my memory here. But it's certainly outside the LIGO horizon, and it's dim. I mean, this is something like, you know, 23rd or 24th magnitude, and you know, you really needed Hubble to see this, right? You really needed the capabilities of Hubble. But if you move it closer and maybe it's a little brighter, you can imagine trying to find one of these things with even a ground-based telescope. So that's an exciting result. Correct. Yes.
Is there some winnowing process by which it's expected that they'll be able to find the object?
Yeah, so there's really good work. There's a lot of work on just this question. I think my favorite paper is by Leo Singer et al. And it's called something like the needle in the haystack. It's called something like finding a transient in 73 square degrees. Okay. And so one model, there's different ways you can imagine doing it, but one model that seems to work for similar types of transients is you can start with a survey instrument that has a big field of view, so something like Palomar Transient Factory, SkyMapper, pan stars, the dark energy survey, right? LSST someday, right? And such a survey can go out and cover, you know, it turns out to take, even with a telescope like that, it takes many tiles, many observations to cover the LIGO band, but many not in infinite, so many meaning like 10-ish. So you can take something like 10-ish tiles. These telescopes all have fields of view of several square degrees. So you end up covering with 10 tiles, you know, 50 or 80 square degrees of sky, which covers a good, not all, but a good fraction of the LIGO position reconstruction area. And then that area has to be searched for transients. And so there's a process that happens. So you start with a simple image subtraction. You get something like tens of thousands of subtraction artifacts. There are some AI machines which are trained to throw out the things that just look like junk and leave you with nice, spherical, beautiful, astrophysical looking things. You end up with a few hundred of those. Those tend to get perused by a graduate student sometime in the middle of the night. The graduate student from those will try to throw out the things that either, you know, there's lots of cuts you can make. Things that are coincident with the center of the galaxy tend to be AGN fluctuations. You know, you can compare against lists of known asteroids. On and on and on. So there's many cuts for going down. And then what you eventually do is you get down to a list of about 10, and then you do photometric observations of those guys, and you get, you know, you get images in different bands. And so now you actually have a crude spectrum. And then you also track those over a few nights, and then based on the light curve profile and the spectral profile, you can do pretty well, and you can actually narrow it down to one or zero guys that might actually be of interest. And they've demonstrated this for gamma ray burst afterglows, which have similar uncertainty regions to LIGO, which gives confidence that this is actually, and at this point, that, you know, Fermi turns out to have some, sorry I'm rambling, but this is a topic of interest to me. So Fermi turns out to have something like, 20 or 50, you know, square degrees of uncertainty. And they've been successful in finding out five or six LIGO, Fermi afterglows. So there do seem to be, it is possible. It's challenging. You have to be aggressive, but it turns out to be possible.
This is assuming that the 70 degrees square degrees that you are claiming, this is assuming all gravitational wave detectors are four. So how does it improve the number of detectors?
Yes, dramatically. Dramatically. So
let's say you have the best case scenario where every single one.
Yeah.
So how well would it be?
It gets down to about a square degree. If in the future,
yeah.
In the future, there, let's say there will be, you know, two LIGO detectors, Virgo, Kagra,
yeah,
maybe even a fifth one in India.
Yeah.
Under those scenarios, we're down to like a few square degrees, and it could fit within like one tile of one of these survey telescopes. So yeah, so I'd say, you know, it's something that's very hard now and will potentially get easier. And the other thing, of course, is that, you know, there's a lot of limitations of astronomy, right? You can't chase after everything with astronomy, right? Maybe it's cloudy. Maybe it's daytime, right? So, you know, only some fraction of events you can actually follow up on. And so in the future, you can imagine the LIGO rates will be higher. Of course, the published rates today are zero, so I hope they will be higher someday. But, you know, in the future, you could imagine the rates being as high as, you know, one per month or one per week. And then, you know, if you try a few times, maybe the fifth or sixth time you try, you can really have some success. So I'm very bullish about this kind of thing working. But I don't think it's going to work. I don't think it's going to be the first thing we do, right? It'll take some time. But time meaning a couple of years, not a decade. So I did want to highlight this idea of heavy elements. And I just want to say that, you know, so the, let's see now, I think the points here, I think, are the measured abundances of these heavy elements in the solar system, and the solid trace is from a simulation by Metzger et al. Predicting the abundances of elements you'd get in one of these R process things coming off of these neutron star remnants. And the message is that it seems to fit very well. There are several peaks which are more or less recovered by the models, but the, you know, the overall rate of the model is unknown by, I'd say, a couple orders of magnitude, right? And that includes uncertainties in how much material comes out per merger, and also uncertainties in what's the merger rate, right? We don't know the merger rate to better than an order of magnitude or two. And so my claim is that LIGO and this process of looking for these kilonovas can really put strong constraints on this model and test it really well. And I'll highlight that, you know, trying to work out the amount of ejecta from each merger, we'll get some information from the luminosity of these kilonova, if and when we observe them. But it's still going to be a process of modeling to turn that into a number of how much matter actually came out. So things like, you know, radiative transfer, but also understanding the merger physics and the tidal forces and all these things are very important for this process. And I liked this plot that tries to show it. I apologize, this plot takes a few minutes to digest. This is from a really nice paper by Kenta Hotokazaka, if I can badly butcher his name with his permission. This is the observed kilonova candidate, and his claim based on the modeling that he's done is that the brightness of it sort of constrained the amount of ejecta from between 1% and 10%. And then this is some estimate of the rate, how often binary neutron stars merge in the galaxy. I think the uncertainties are actually a little bit bigger than he's drawing here. But then what's really nice here is he shows this line on top of it, which is the observed solar system abundance of these R process elements. And he plays this interesting game where he says, well, this is, you know, how much ejecta we think comes out of a binary neutron star merger. This is how often we think binary neutron star mergers happen. And so that sort of constrains you to this box. And then the amount of heavy elements we observe in the solar system does do a pretty good job going right through the middle of that box. And what I think is a beautiful thing is that as LIGO starts to observe these things, we're really going to be putting points, data points on this plot, right? I think that this will become a very, I think this will become a very strong test of this model over the next few years. Correct. Yeah, correct. Yeah. Okay, good.
Just one quick thing. Please. So this is what you drilled in for very heavy things. Does this also produce relatively light?
It does, but in lower abundances. So the point is that it does.
Well, okay, and then the question was the contrast between that and how fast does supernova drop off, and is there some tension here, or are they basically complementary?
I think they're basically complementary. So basically, you know, for the lighter things, the supernovas seem to explain the abundances, and these do drop off at the lighter elements. So I think the basic thinking is that the lighter elements are sort of dominated by supernova, and that these heavier elements are potentially, we don't know, but are potentially dominated by these BNS mergers. Okay, so of course general relativity is tested in many regimes, but the strong field I think is not as well tested. I think that's a true claim. And certainly by any standard, black hole mergers are in the strong field limit. I think in some sense they are the strong field limit. I don't really know what would be stronger. You know,
anything more fun skills.
No, higher curvature regime, right? Because the actual R is
a big black hole has very small tidal forces in the horizon.
That's true, right? That's true.
So
they're important.
R is,
that's right. So I do understand that the definition of strong is even debatable, or your measure of strong. What's the metric for strong, right? But I think
the strongest.
We'll say it's a. I think we can agree that they're a source of strong gravity, right? By any metric. I think there are several different ways that we can try to test this with LIGO, right? A really kind of basic thing we can do is compare observed waveforms with waveforms predicted by general relativity. And what I have in mind is numerical general relativity, but of course there are other ways of generating waveforms. And in some sense, I think this is a very good test of, say, dynamics in the strong field limit, right? This is telling you something about how things are moving. So there are these nice papers by, say, Nico Yunis and company, where they show how the phase envelope, so you have a binary merger, and as the merger evolves, the phase evolves, right? And so what we measure in the gravitational wave band is this phase evolution. And you can compare that phase evolution with predictions from general relativity. And this is nice because there's a whole post-Einsteinian framework for quantifying this. There's these quasi-normal modes. So the black holes merge. And at the moment of merger, what you have is a, you know, perturbed Kerr space-time. And that's going to radiate energy in these quasi-normal modes. And seeing if those quasi-normal modes that we observe matches expectations based on general relativity, in some sense is a test of if it's really a black hole, or in another sense could be if you accept that it's some kind of black hole, you can see that as a test of the no-hair theorem, which is really nice. You can check for extra polarization modes. Max Isi at Caltech has been looking at this for continuous wave sources. But the idea here is that if you have, say, a scalar tensor theory of gravity, then maybe you don't, you know, in general relativity, of course, there are two gravitational wave polarizations. There's the plus and the cross. But if you have some, say, scalar tensor theory, maybe you allow, say, a breathing mode, you know, a scalar gravitational wave polarization. Maybe some other polarizations are possible. So we can look. We can see if we see those. And then there's also this idea, things like have massive graviton theories, have gravitational wave propagation speed, which does not match the speed of light. And in some cases, like say if the gravitational wave was in coincident with a gamma ray burst or some other dramatic emission from a neutron star merger, we may be able to say measure the propagation speed of the gravitational wave. And that would be a way of testing massive graviton theories. So I wanna try and highlight this a little bit and show some of the work that's been done in this direction. So here I'm trying to highlight that we're working in our group on extracting gravitational waveforms from noisy data. So we have noisy data from two detectors. And in this is a very high signal noise ratio example, but in this example, there's a red simulated waveform, which we've added to the data. And then we've run our pipeline to try and recover that waveform, which is the blue trace is the waveform recover. So this is to give just some kind of picture, but the more quantitative plot is here, where it's a function of network SNR. We plot how well we recover the waveform. And for pretty reasonable SNRs, things that we can realistically hope to detect with advanced LIGO, say network SNRs of 15, which is pretty close to our detection threshold, or maybe SNRs of 20, we can recover waveforms with something like 90 or 95% overlap. So, you know, as the SNR goes up, I mean, this isn't like a shocking result, but as the SNR goes up, our ability to recover the waveform really goes to, you know, to 95 or even 100%. And what was, I think what's been a little bit surprising to me is how low in SNR we can go down to network SNRs of say 15 or so, and still be talking about 80 or 90% overlap in our recovered SNR. So I do think that we're gonna be able to extract waveforms from the data, which can then be compared with say general relativity. So that's the beautiful thing is that this is done with a burst pipeline. So this, as it happens, this is something that I'm working on personally. And so we use a very general model. So the model is just that the waveform is a linear superposition of some number of sine Gaussian wavelets, and we don't fix the number. And so the point is that this does not assume any waveform family. And so it's really, you know, it's really just asking a naive question of the data. Data, tell me what waveform is in you. And so then if that waveform matches general relativity, that's a surprise. I mean, not a surprise, but that's a real measurement, right? So there is an important distinction. Of course, there's a whole other class of work that goes on where you start with a waveform family, assume general relativity is more or less right, and then try to, say, constrain the parameters of the binary.
We could provide it with some waveforms from an alternative theory.
Yeah.
And then see if you can get it out.
Yeah, it'd be great.
So how do you start the waveform? Like, do you have like any templates?
So there are different efforts. We're a big collaboration, and so we try waveform reconstructions in several different ways. The one that I'm showing here does not assume a template. The one that I'm showing here. Has a very naive model that just tries to reconstruct the data as a superposition. That we use these little sine Gaussian wavelets. They're not physical in any sense. They're just these little wavelet packets. And we use superpositions of them, right? So of course, if you have enough wavelets, right, you can reconstruct any waveform, right? And so we use sort of a basis of sine Gaussians. But the point is that it's a basis that covers, in some sense, the space of all possible waveforms. And we see how many of those we need to use in order to fit what we see in the data. Does that make sense? actually uses a Markov chain Monte Carlo. It's a little fancy. Okay. So one of the really promising tests of general relativity are these quasi-normal modes. And so, you know, again, you have this binary merger. So now I'm thinking about, say, two black holes, right? So maybe a neutron star that collapses to a black hole. And then, of course, at the moment of merger, it's in a very perturbed state. And so it's going to you know, release energy in these quasi-normal modes. There's sort of these modes, there's sort of two, you know, real observables, right? There's the frequency of the mode and the decay time. And what you can do is you can try and map these frequencies and decay times to, right, if Noether's theorem is true and these black holes aren't charged, and I don't know why they should be charged, then these black holes should be described by two parameters, right? Their mass and their spin. So you can try and you've got two observables, say the frequency and decay time of your loudest mode. So you should, from, say, one mode, be able to determine the mass and spin of the final black hole. If you can determine that mass and spin in some other way as well, then now you have a test, right? You have a cross-check if Noether theorem is really working.
What frequency does this usually fall in? Because this is the highest frequency you can have, right, after the merger.
Yes, that's true.
So does it fall in your optimal frequency?
Yeah, so
it depends on the mass of the system.
It depends on the mass of the system. But
let's say black hole mergers,
yeah.
Which I guess would be the best time.
Yeah.
Place.
Yeah. In that,
so does it fall in the band or is it like you have to have a large mass system?
Let's see. So binary neutron stars merge at something like a couple of kilohertz.
Okay.
And that's sort of the upper end of our band.
Yeah.
So as you start to, you know, as you talk about, say, you know, two 10 solar mass black holes that would merge to, say, 20 solar masses, that would be, you know, you'd be in pretty good shape, right? So I think you're sort of optimal more like around probably 40 or 50 solar mass black holes, but I think 10 solar mass black holes would be in band.
Yeah.
Well, they're highly uncertain, right?
Yeah, yeah,
so
but how does it compare, let's say, black hole neutron star versus black hole?
Yeah, well,
they're all about the same.
Yeah, so that's a really, right, that's an important point, right? So I'd say the best guess for the rates are all about the same. The black hole, any rates involving a black hole tend to be much more uncertain because we can't constrain those rates with pulsars, right? So pulsars give us some
idea of the information.
That's right. So we think we can guess that and only be off by an order of magnitude. With black hole rates, kind of the best guesses come from populations that I know about, come from population synthesis, work by people like Chris Belchinsky and Vicky Calagara, and they come up with numbers that are similar to the binary neutron star rate, right? Which is important that we can see a lot further into the universe for them. But I'd say the uncertainties are bigger. There are some papers that actually, you know, the uncertainties are bigger, so there are even papers that claim that the binary black hole rate will actually be higher than the binary neutron star rate. Okay, so we've got one quasi-normal mode which can measure the mass and spin of the black hole. If Noether theorem is true, then you have no more degrees of freedom. So if you can measure those quantities any other way, you now have a test of general relativity. Maybe you can do that by observing higher order modes, though I think in most those are expected to be suppressed. On the other hand, there's a simpler thing we can do, which is that we try to measure the masses and spins of the black holes based on the in-spiral, right? So you get one measurement of the mass and spins of the component black holes based on the in-spiral portion of the signal. And then at the moment of merger, you have this quasi-normal mode, which gives you a second measurement, which you can then compare, and that becomes a test of general relativity. And I did want to highlight that I think this testing general relativity potentially becomes a rich topic. So in this slide is in some sense an invitation for people in the room to think about what this might look like in 2 or 3 years. Or there are questions about like how well could you, you know, the interpretation I think is going to be challenging. How well can you really constrain general relativity? I think that's a very non-trivial problem. I think it involves asking hard questions about how good our simulations are, how good our waveforms are, how well can we constrain the parameters of the binary, what are systematic uncertainties in our detectors. I think, you know, one of the things that I wonder about, and this is a really naive question, and it's maybe even a stupid question, but I wonder about what are the gravitational wave signatures of non-GR theories. I wonder if there are, or could be, non-general relativity waveforms in existence, or that could be generated for testing against. This is me talking way outside my comfort zone. I have no idea what I'm talking about, but it might be something to get people in this room thinking. And also, what aspects of general relativity can be best tested with this, with gravitational wave measurement? So I was really interested to read about these quasi-nomial modes and that it provides, you know, potentially a strong test of the no-Hare theorem. What about cosmic censorship? What about these other, you know, principles of general relativity? How would you try to constrain them with this data? And I don't claim to know the answers. Okay, good. So there were a lot of really good questions, and I think I've been talking a really long time. So I appreciate all of the good questions, and I will not punish you with a long talk, unless this is just your favorite topic. All right, so let's say a few. I'll cut. Yeah, I'm gonna cut to the chase on this, I promise. Okay, so I won't try to introduce the neutron star equation of state other than to say it's very uncertain. Maybe what I'll say is that there are many models for the neutron star equation of state. Each of these curves represents a different model. Each model represents some curve in, say, radius mass space of a neutron star, okay? And so the point is that anytime you have a neutron star where you can measure both the mass and the radius, you're constraining these models, right? And actually, these lines on here are examples of neutron stars. I think this one's a pulsar, where the mass has been measured, and just the existence, you know, there's no measurement of the radius here, but just the existence of a two solar mass neutron star rules out, or at least, you know, puts into tension many of these models. But then many of these models survive this cut, and as far, I don't think there's constraints much better than this. So there's still a lot of uncertainty as to what this equation of state really looks like. There's many ways to probe this with gravitational waves. There's a lot of work being done on this. There's work by people like Jocelyn Reed and Johnny Lee who are looking if, as the mergers evolves, there are tidal forces. The tidal forces elongate the neutron star, and that has implications for the phase evolution of the in-spiral part. Okay, so tidal deformations lead to a change in the phase evolution during the in-spiral. And that's potentially measurable. And there are people studying how well that can be measured and how well you can constrain equation of state based on that. So you're basically measuring what people call the tidal love number, just how much the neutron star elongates during the merger. And that's potentially extractable during the in-spiral. There's this very complementary work in terms of after the merger, if you have one of these hypermassive neutron stars, right? So, and in many simulations, right? Even if the mass is large enough that you'd expect it to collapse because there's rotation or whatever else, there's a hypermassive neutron star that survives for, say, tens of milliseconds or hundreds of milliseconds. And the point is that it's what's really interesting is that hypermassive neutron star has some resonance of its own, right? I think these are more or less mechanical resonances of the hypermassive neutron star. And I'm trying to plot that here. So in this plot, right, this is each of these curves represents a gravitational wave spectra of some simulated neutron star. This is frequency on the x-axis. And depending on the equation of state, you get peaks in different places. And these peaks are telling you about some resonance of the neutron star, right, which is very closely tied to its radius, right? So the point is that by...
These are normal modes of the star.
Normal modes, just like that,
Yeah, that was a recollection of what happened with the merger. They merged different radius.
Yeah.
have the objects merging at different frequencies, yes, and that there's a remnant of that, so you can decompose all that information.
And there's actually a claim from the the people who are simulating these things, that there's actually a very tight relationship between the frequency of this normal mode and the radius of the neutron star. And maybe if you think of it as like a normal mode, maybe that's obvious, right? Maybe it's just, I don't know, the sound. I'm making things up here now, but the sound travel time across the star or something like that, right? So so the claim is that just by measuring one of these peaks in the gravitational wave spectrum, just measuring the frequency, and of course frequency is easy to measure, then you can actually constrain the equation of state pretty well. There's a really nice paper by James Clark that he just put on the archive about this.
And you don't know if someone will be able to constrain the relation
between
the two.
In terms of
the accuracy, right? How well will you be
able to? Well, I will tell you what the masses are,
yes,
for now, you know the radius.
Yeah. So what the mass you probably, so what accuracy can be measured by extracting the waveform? It depends on what your signal to noise ratio is.
Absolutely.
Before.
Yeah, but the accuracy.
So let's say that it's.
So the claim is that. The claim is that this radius,
yeah,
can be measured to like a few hundred meters. Mm-hmm. So something like, you know, error bars kind of like this.
And like 10% or 30%.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there is
an SNR issue here.
Yeah.
So
because it depends on how far this is.
That's right. And the bad news is that, you know, these peaks, the power that's in these peaks is not as much as the power that's in the in-spiral. So where we talk about like a 200 megaparsec range for an in-spiral, right, to see any binary neutron star merger, it would have to be closer than that to pick off one of these peaks. So the ranges that people talk about where you could actually measure one of these peaks, maybe 50 megaparsecs are the kinds of distances. So it'd have to be kind of a closer, louder signal. But, you know, who knows?
See something already, maybe it's in the range.
But you also have to remember, at this stage, you're in the supplementary information regime, because you can then use this,
mm-hmm,
compared with, so would you have a kilometer or not? So we claim that you have the obvious, or say, 15 kilometers radius merging,
mm-hmm,
it would not be a kilometer. So now you can use the economic side to supplement information and then build up a stronger case by the combination.
Yeah, and actually one of the really interesting papers on this, not using this piece of the information at all, but one of the interesting papers, I think Johnny Lee is the lead author, and they're looking at these tidal love numbers and but what they show that's interesting is they claim that if you observed many of these systems, if you observed 20 or 30 or 40 of them over, say, some number of years, then you could actually sort of add up, kind of stack the signals, and that you could beat your signal-to-noise ratio that way. So even if they were all kind of low SNR, kind of the combination of many of them could be used to try and pull out this information. So I'm optimistic that this is one of the realistic targets for LIGO. I think this is science that we could realistically be doing in a few years. Okay, so Advanced LIGO recently began taking data. I think the status is looking really good. There will be continued improvements over, say, the next 5 years. The data is searched for transients. We do search in low latency, which allows us to work with our astronomer partners. LIGO data is accessible in several ways, all of which are available at the LIGO Open Science Center, lost.ligo.org. I encourage you to take a look. And I'm very optimistic that astrophysics and fundamental physics will be explored with the new observatories. Thank you all very much. Yeah, so we did before the run started, we did lay down a kind of plan for this kind of thing. And the nominal plan was that from something like the end of the run to publication would be something like 3 months. So at the moment we're in the 01, the first observing run, right? And so the nominal plan would be, well, the observing run is planned to end sometime in December. And so if you figure 3 months after that, you're probably talking about February or March. But something like 3 months after the end of any observing run is kind of our nominal plan.
Well, related to that, that question. So suppose you see something that maybe it could be a glitch, could be something, because you're sending this information to the EML server.
Yes, and they expect to receive some number of glitches, right? We've set our thresholds very low so that some fraction of what they receive.
But they take a look.
They take a look.
Getting signal.
Yes.
Now what?
What happens, like, when, in terms of publications?
Yeah, what can they do?
If they see something.
But so they go and they deploy that, they don't have to do this whole detailed analysis.
They
go to.
They just look at it. They find something and then tell.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so I think, so, you know, there are these memorandums of understanding with the astronomers. And I think the language in there is that they're supposed to collaborate closely with the LIGO collaboration, and there's supposed to be some kind of joint publication plan. So I think the way the rules are structured, it is not permissible for them to sort of, you know,
go solo. Right. That's not the expectation.
You know,
another question is, you might worry that if there's just kind of one game in town that there might be a tendency to err on the side of caution, as opposed to if there were two competing groups, you might, you know, the safety threshold would be lowered and you'd see more slightly less reliable reported detections. Can you maybe summarize to what extent the idea is to only report things that are super gold-plated detection versus also reporting interesting and iffy things?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we would report interesting, not I think, we would report interesting outliers, right? I mean, we have traditionally when we publish our results, you know, we put in sort of a background curve and a foreground curve. And in that foreground curve, any outliers you would sort of see by eye, and I think we would be compelled to comment on them, right? And in the past, there's some precedent for this, right? We've had some, I don't know if you're familiar, but we have these kind of blind injection culture where you know, signals may or may not be added to the detector data without telling the analysts. And there was a case where there was a blind injection, and we found it with a very marginal significance. We found it with a significance of, call it 98% confidence, right? So something like 2 or 3 sigma level confidence. And the sort of way that we were prepared to describe it, we didn't write this paper because we were then told it was a blind injection, but the way we were prepared to describe it was as an interesting outlier that, you know, we couldn't claim as a detection, but here's what, you know, here's the stuff we found in our data. And so the answer is, yeah, we wouldn't, you know, we're not in the business of keeping secrets, right? We're in the business of doing our analysis before sharing the results.
But in a sense, you're similar to what Atlas and CMS and the NHC, like you have the burst group and the CDC group, and then they work independently, and then they compare.
Yes, if anything, we have, I mean, in terms of analyses, right, if anything, we have too many search codes, right? I mean, even within the CBC group, there are not one but two CBC search pipelines. And within the BURST group, there are not one but arguably three BURST search pipelines. So we are in the business of, and we believe that should we ever see anything, we believe that that would be valuable for, say, validation. So, you know, so not so much in terms of like, well, I don't, you know, I don't know that it's a, you know, it's not strictly competition, but it's valuable in terms of, say, doing a full search of the data, I would say.
Another question?
Well, on the negative side of things, if we don't see anything, do we start to get nervous?
Well, yeah, so I do. So this is the problem. This is the problem with that, right? This is the concern, is that the uncertainties on the rate of compact object mergers in the universe are significant, right? And if, you know, let's say LIGO got to design sensitivity ran for a year or two and saw no compact object mergers, right? I think, you know, that would, that scenario is only barely in tension with the sort of low end of what's possible for the astrophysical rates. And so there's this really depressing fact that we don't talk about very often, which is that, you know, you'd like to be able to say, yeah, I mean, again, it's the very low end of the rate predictions, right? So the reason that there's good reason, you know, one, there's many reasons to be optimistic, but one reason there's reason to be optimistic is that, you know, your best guess for the binary neutron star rate, the best guess based on galactic pulsars and population synthesis, is that advanced LIGO at design sensitivity would see something like 10 to 100 of them per year. I mean, you're really talking about one per week or one per month. So the best guess is that they'd be really common. But then the kind of lower end of that uncertainty is a rate right around one per year or one per couple of years. So to really be in tension with that, you'd have to run advanced LIGO at design sensitivity for like 5 years or so. So I'm hoping nature will be kinder than that. I'm hoping that we won't be in that position. But unfortunately, you know, getting all the way through the possible astrophysical parameter space would be a bit of a slog. It would take a few years.
Well, nature may be really kind, but not
bad.
Gravitational waves.
Or just... Yeah, I mean, that's right, you know. Yeah, I mean, that would be very exciting, right? I mean, we've always said... No, but that's right. I mean, we've always...
I hope that doesn't happen, but maybe that's made up to do
it. It's something, I mean, it's always something that we, it's something we've always claimed, is that if we ran for years and saw nothing, then it would put some, you know, then it would be, we should go back to the drawing board and we should think. Yeah, I mean, that would be, but my worry, I hope, like, that would be very exciting, right? But my guess is that were we to do that, I think that the astrophysicists, could, you know, I think the astrophysicists who predict these rates, I think that they would. I think they would do your work for you, right? I think that their parameter. So I. No. It's, look, it's a really fair question, right? And so in principle, I think we could get to that point where intention, and would certainly raise questions, but I just think the astrophysics has some wiggle room. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and so, you know, we're sensitive. Advanced LIGO, a design sensitivity will be sensitive to most of the galaxy, maybe not all the galaxy, depending on your model, but we'll be sensitive to most of the galaxy. You know, the galactic supernova rate is like one per 30 years ish. Okay, so what's that?
One per century.
So I think we would have to be, you know, so it would require some amount of luck, I think, for us to, you know. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, the other way to spin that is that.
Yeah, oh, yes, of course, that's the other thing. Sure.
It's purely, yeah, so it's one of them. So, but you know, I think, so I do think we'd have to be lucky to see one in the next few years. I think the other way you could spin this is, you know, hopefully we're at the very beginning of gravitational wave astronomy. And so, you know, there are graduate students working very hard on the physics, and more senior people too, working very hard on the, on, yeah, I mean, I think, but I realistically, I think that's true. I think over a 30-year career, why not, right? So maybe not this year, but maybe, you know, in a career. Yeah, yeah.
Maybe it won't happen in our lifetime.
But it could.
Yeah.
It could, right?
Okay, on that note, thanks,
Joey. Thanks, everyone.